So, welcome to another episode of the Two Johns Sci-Fi Podcast. As John Nelson mentioned, we have upped our production game just a little bit, but it took, a little bit of doing. Anyway, if you're on Facebook Live, you can tune in and ask questions. You can also go over to Instagram, freshpulp/freshpulp or @freshpulp, and we're streaming live there as well, and you can ask us questions.
And we'll see the questions where?
We'll see the questions. I'm actually going to open it up right here.
Oh, good. That way I'll be able to see you see the questions.
Yes. See?
Aha! That is fantastic. I like this.
I think that people will be able to ask us questions right here. But I'm going to open another tab just to be on the safe side. So, there's a little bit of latency, too. You notice that?
No. I didn't notice that. I was thinking that maybe it was just how long it took light to travel. That maybe we were actually...
The 3 feet.
Several light seconds away from the screen.
Yes.
The funny thing is that nobody else can see what we're seeing, so they're just sitting there sort of...
Going, what are you guys talking about?
How about this? While you're doing that, I'll go into the little items from the loot crate. So that people actually... So we're putting together a loot crate, and the criteria for getting the loot crate...
The criteria for getting the loot crate is we're going to pick people, commenters, people who have liked recently liked, and commenters, we're going to... We're going to pick somebody at random out of the Fresh Pulp fan page or the Instagram fan page and eventually the YouTube fan page. And we're going to pick somebody at random and we're going to send them some good stuff.
Yep, some good sci-fi related nerdy stuff. And in the first loot crate are a few items. This one is not really easy to see, but what it is a sphere of glass with a 3D representation of, it looks like the Milky Way, but it could be any spiral galaxy. And it's really gorgeous. I mean, you've seen this, right?
Yes, it is nice.
It is really beautiful. And, nerdy, because it just when you're just spinning it around.
Yes.
Like I was really worried when I because I ordered this online. I was really worried that it wouldn't be as cool as I thought it was going to be. Yeah. But then when I got it, I mean, you just sit there. When I first unpacked it to make sure that it was okay and it wasn't broken, I just sit there and I realized, it's 3 hours later.
So the sudden impulse to juggle.
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, if I were going to keep it, if it were mine. And then a couple of T-shirts, which with classic sci-fi themes. And this is the first one.
The racy one.
Yes, this is a rather racy one, but it's, you know, got the classic sci-fi theme of the alien invasion. This one's the film. As a matter of fact, I think this is a real poster.
I mean, I'm okay with, like, the sort of the retro, like, 50s, 60s stuff. But if you're trying to, like, if you're really just into dismantling the space hierarchy, yeah. then you may not, you might find this offensive. Like, and I would totally get that. Yeah. So,
but I do believe this is an actual movie poster from an actual movie.
Yes, like,
Invasion of the Saucer Men.
Right. They kind of based Mars Attacks on it, I think.
Yeah. And the last one, which, as you pointed out, is kind of like the Tor.
Yeah, it looks like a Tor rocket. It's very, like the 50s style with the rivets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, in future, I think, at least I'm going to try in the T-shirt realm to maybe get other colors of T-shirt. I just realized I got two black T-shirts, and I wonder whether I couldn't have gotten
a yellow.
Yeah.
A little diversity in T-shirt picking, absolutely.
Or red. anyway, so we're going to be doing this ever so often, just gathering up cool sci-fi related, swag. And sending it out to our
to people
who watch just simply because it's kind of cool. The sort of things that you see, I mean, I'm always out and I see things that are either sci-fi or fantasy related or just historical and I want to buy it all. But of course, then you have to live in a warehouse. But this gives us a way to actually buy this stuff and it doesn't clutter up our own homes. We can actually send it off to clutter up other people's homes and other people's closets.
It's part of our like master plan.
Yeah, we're sort of outsourcing clutter to your life. So if you want to participate in that, just,
Absolutely. I'm down. We're going to try and do these like once a month.
Yeah.
So, we'll accumulate stuff.
At the very least. Maybe, every once in a while we might be able to bump it up to once every episode if we just happen to get a bonanza, because I have a feeling like if there's this
I'm always in the search for good swag.
Yeah, and there's a particular antique and used furniture shop that I go to, and every once in a while when I walk in there, a lot of times you go in and you're like, I didn't see anything I like today, but then sometimes you go in there and it's like 15-20 items that are just unpassable, you know?
Yes.
And so, you know, every once in a while, if we do have a...
That's like once a week for me, by the way.
A bonanza of just cool sci-fi stuff, then, we might bump it up.
T-shirts, it could be anything, really. It could also be...
Yeah.
We're to play it by ear. But yeah. I've got some ideas.
Because we might be surprised. I mean, I saw some stuff the other day when we were at the... passing by the street fair. Mm-hmm. In Arlington, that I almost thought I should get that, but then I was like, well, don't
go overboard. Steampunk stuff.
Yeah, some awesome steampunk, some little sculptures that look like little robots that someone had made, an artist had made. So that sort of thing that we think that you would like if you're the kind of person who's tuning into a sci-fi podcast.
Yeah. All right. So what are we on for today? What's on for our first episode?
I believe that we were, after the Loot Crate, we want to go to this book that we reviewed.
Yes.
Or the book that we read. Wow. Okay.
I don't say wow very often when it comes to science fiction books, I got to tell
this
you.
This book right here, I don't know how well you can see it, so. It is called Sisyphean.
Yes.
And it is by Denpal Torishima.
Yeah.
And it is...
By the way, he's from Osaka. Osaka in the house, what's up?
Yeah, Tomboy. And it was, and also he did, there are a lot of illustrations in here.
Yes.
Very abstract, but they do have something to do with the story. And he also did those illustrations. And to me, that sort of made this an even more interesting book, because it's kind of like, well, the way Tolkien did, Tolkien made his own illustrations, and those are some of the best editions of his books are the ones where you're like, oh, this is what this is supposed to look like.
Yes.
Because the guy who wrote it added. But this was written, apparently, in Japanese and translated by, I want to give this guy the shout out too, for reasons we'll go into as we've discussed, the translation is fantastic.
I actually cannot see, I can see the screen, but I can't see the scrolling comments.
Oh.
So who can you see who's logged in from here?
No, I cannot. You mean on the bottom?
Yeah. Looks like Kamran Pasha. Is that you, Kamran Pasha? Welcome. And it looks like Miriam has also logged in. Hello, Miriam. Welcome. And he said something, but I can't see what it is, because for some reason the feed... we upped everything, but the feed's not piping through at the moment. So,
These little glitches and growing pains. Yes. But You gotta take a chance and see where it goes.
So let's get back to Sisyphean, which, by the way, isn't just the title of the book. It refers to the task.
It is the book. Yes, reading the book is itself very much a task of rolling the stone of I understand what this is about up a hill, and then it rolls right back down, and you're like, oh, I have no idea what this book is about.
Yeah,
But it's so intriguing. The setting is incredibly intriguing, and I was about to give a shout out to Daniel Huddleston,
right,
who is the translator, because this is so, the prose in this is so rich, and the words are just the phrases and every single sentence. I mean, this is barely an exaggeration, but nearly every single sentence in this book has a neologism in it.
Yep.
Some creature or technology or something that is unique to this setting. And the translator, I'm assuming, bringing into English something that the writer already did in Japanese, makes them not imposing. They're so close to, like, there's this one place where there's a sort of a womb-like sleep sack.
Yeah.
That one of the characters is sleeping in, and it has amnesiotic fluid.
Right. It's not amniotic fluid, but amnesiotic fluid.
So
before we get into,
oh my gosh,
before we get into the language and everything else, let me get into how I found the book.
Right. Yeah. The origins of this.
The origins, because
this kind of threw me for a loop when you sent this to me, and I kind of read the
but you're always really good about that, because I was like, you know what, I've got a book for our next podcast, and you were like, what is it? And I was like, Sisyphean, and you're like, I ordered it.
Well, yeah, the moment you told me to get it, I was like, okay. And I
went, it was like 45 seconds. It was like 10 seconds. It was like, I ordered it on Amazon.
So, yeah. Hey, when you're in the military, when you've been in the military, you just like, boom, let's do this. Let's get this mission over. Go, go. So, yeah, every time you do suggest something, unless I look at it and I have an immediate, like, why?
If we're going to screw up, there's going to be like a gun-shaped hole.
Yeah, exactly.
Through the wall, right?
I say, okay, whatever. So I just grabbed it up based off the description that I saw on Amazon.
Yeah.
And, but really, because I looked at it and I thought, okay, yeah, I'm up for that. But I still was like, what is it about this book? Yeah. And I thought maybe that it was simply because the original was in Japanese. And I thought, okay, he wants to sort of...
Well, I saw it in Strange Horizons, and at first, I didn't even realize, at the very first, like for the first 5 minutes I was looking at the book, I was like, I didn't realize that it was a translation.
Oh.
So then I saw it on Strange Horizons, and I was like, oh, this is interesting. And then I saw, I think it was like Nick Mamatas on his Facebook page, he had posted someone's review of it. And I didn't actually read that review, but I was like, oh, this is like the second time I've seen this. And like,
right, so people are buzzing about it.
Yeah, a little bit. And so I was also like, okay, well, it came out last year, but the translation evidently just came out. So I wanted something a little fresh. I wanted something that was, you know, non-American or European.
Right.
And also, like, I just finished reading a horror book by a Japanese author. It was like a horror, science fiction horror book. And honestly, it wasn't, I read the translation, but it occurred to me once I read some of the reviews in English and Japanese that, like, Japanese neuroses comes through in art really powerfully.
So the cultural...
Yeah. You know, like, even if you look at something like The Ring or The Grudge, you see the hair. The hair is a thing.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I was like, let's it could be weird.
Right.
So that's how I found it.
And it is.
It's weird.
It is one of the weirdest, if not the weirdest, book that I've ever read.
Well, I said it was Douglas Adams, and you aptly said William Burroughs.
Yeah.
So we say it's Douglas Adams...
Yep.
If William S. Burroughs had a love child and took himself too seriously,
right.
Like that's pretty much what this book
is. And the language is almost like, and I hesitate to say this because it's, but it's like James Joyce, except that this isn't gibberish. It actually is just, but it's so filled with novelty that it really does. It's one of those things that it's only like 300 pages. Like,
I thought it was four.
It's four, four. How far is it?
It's like 418, I think.
No, it's like 30. Oh, no, you're right. But it's just not that long of a book, but that has taken me longer to read. It just...
I have to go back and read.
You, it's like food that you just have to slowly eat. You can't just breeze through it. Some books are just so, you know, just like this, but this is so filled with... It's so textured.
Yes.
The world that this guy is creating is so textured.
Extremely textured.
And, I don't know, how are we going to describe this world? Because there are four stories
I would say the world is more of a sensation than, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
He built the world through sensations. So, you know, one of the first images that comes at you from this book is like meat and like
right.
slime and, you know, it's
very visceral.
It's very, yeah, and you mentioned the other day, it wasn't like shock factor. I wasn't like,
no.
Oh my God, I'm going to vomit, even though...
I read some
parts
reviews.
Parts that made me hungry.
Right, yeah, that's the weird part, is that I had read some reviews that hinted that this could be considered body horror, and there's a lot of gross stuff. There are a lot of bugs exploding and things happening to people, you know, people having their own children just burst out of their
yeah.
out of their bellies and having their own bodies pulled apart and glued back together, actually gooed back together.
Right, yes.
And everything is organic. Like
everything.
Every light on the wall, every tool. The first story has someone who is actually creating organs for sale to this client. And even the tools he uses are worms
right.
and bugs.
And sedges.
And
birds, right? There, yeah.
Yeah. And
the Shizu.
But you know, as I'm reading through this, and I'm thinking to myself, is this body horror? Because it's a lot of gross stuff. But what he does, and this I will compare him to Joyce, because I believe Joyce's concept of art was that it's not supposed to agitate you, it's supposed to bring you to a calm.
Right.
And he has the same sort of things, imagery in here, that would be in body horror, or that would be in a sort of, I don't know what you would call it, a gross out?
Yeah.
Like a sort of gross, weird fiction. But at the end of it, the whole point of the story is to present it in a way that you realize that the characters in the story have just become used to it. This is just their world.
Right. They normalized
it. Right. It's been normalized, and you get normalized in it to the point where, as the book goes on, it just has to keep... There's this sort of constant amping up of the weirdness in a way that completely keeps pace with your comfort level
yeah.
with the weirdness that you just got past. It's
truly bizarre. Each chapter is acclimating you to the subsequent chapters.
Right.
So
yeah.
it's like...
Yeah.
Okay, here's this gross thing happening, and then
and not in a perverse way,
right?
Like, I don't want to make this sound like he's getting you used to these this weird sort of constant just mash of bodies and organs and fluids and just.
I called it the completed and realized vision of Naked Lunch.
Yes, when you're past trying to be transgressive and intentionally offensive and all that, and you're just in a point where this stuff just is.
Yes.
And that's why I was telling you, the word that struck me was, it's an undystopia.
Yes.
If you can see how this exact same world presented in a different way could be a dystopia, and it would be, you know, if another writer had tried to do this, you'd end up with a book that you had to put down every 5 seconds because you wanted to empty your guts into the sink. But weirdly, you don't do this with this.
Right.
It's just unbelievably
there's
bizarre.
Like, there are
moments where you go,
there's like a little dry heaving.
you never get to the point where it's unbearable. Ugh. It just gets to the point where you're like, okay, and then you move past it.
Yeah.
And then I
would be weirdly hungry. I would dry heave a little bit. I'm like, oh, man, that's a weird texture.
And then
I'd be like, you know what, I'm kind of. Yes, that's, you know, you're right.
They're always eating.
Somebody always consuming something.
Yeah.
It's something nematodes with cilia attaching itself, and it's like, okay, that's.
Or little bugs that actually scream at you not to kill them as you're killing them.
You've gotten to the root of my psychological attachment to this book.
It's just.
My hunger, and I'm a nematode. Like existentially, I'm, you know.
So
you saw Brazil recently.
I because you compared it.
Well, because there's a sort of, like the worker, the very first story, which is one that kind of set the pace for me.
Right, it was a guy who was creating organs for a client, and he's working for some kind of a unicellular creature called a president.
He was translucent.
Like a blob, a translucent blob with a tongue-shaped head.
Right, a translucent body, a corpusite.
Yeah, that you could look in and see the organ. Not only see the organ, this guy's organs, but also the creatures that he had recently ingested.
Right.
Their bodies floating around in this corpusite.
And there was a desperation to his labor, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To his labor, like his
The worker was.
Because his whole story was told from his perspective, and so everything was kind of internal. And, you know, the thing that kind of, that really bothered, it didn't bother me, but the thing that made me like sort of like Brazil was, this guy had just, was just resigned. Like the guy in Brazil, he was beat down.
Yeah.
And he's just like, okay, he's drinking now. Okay, you know he's going to vomit now.
Right.
Oh, he vomited.
Yeah.
Okay.
His boss started drinking and then vomited all over the place.
Right. So, so there was this desolation to it, but there was also this structure.
Right.
In the story, like, oh, I just came out of this sleep sack. And now I'm going to put on my coveralls, and now I'm going to go to work, and now I'm going to. And it was just really regimented, and I was like, "Man, this is like Brazil, except minus the girl."
Right.
So
it was very much. As a matter of fact, I watched Brazil after you mentioned that. I said, I had been meaning to watch it for a long time because it's, you know, apparently one of the best movies, and I would have to agree.
The 54th greatest movie of all time, according to
exactly the 54th.
Yes,
not the 53rd.
Well, after I told you about it, I was like, let me go back and.
Right. No, I saw some of the reviews too, and I like Gilliam, and I had seen Time Bandits.
Yeah, I mean, weirdly, what?
I'm saying because that's
fired watching for anybody.
That's considered to be like part of a trilogy. There's Time Bandits, and then Brazil, and then Munchausen.
Munchausen is
a trilogy of his. And
right.
I had seen Time, and I like Time Bandits. I'm just not sure why I never did see Brazil. It's just one of those things that. It just slipped. And there are a lot of movies from the 80s that I didn't watch in the 80s and I won't watch because...
A guy like steampunk powered armor fighting a giant samurai. I mean, how can you not? When I was a kid, I gotta watch that.
Yeah, that part of it, it was a little, seemed a little 70s to me. It was a little 70s to me. But no, I like that movie, but you're right. In the first part, the first arc of Sisyphean, the workers... sort of resignation to the work. And here's the weird thing. Because in a lot of stories like that, you'd not have just resignation. You would have just absolute depression and that you'd get... But this guy was like, okay, here we got to do this, and we got to do this. And they're sort of... it didn't quite descend into that. There was never this woe is me sort of sense that you get in a lot of these stories. Which there was a little bit of that in Brazil.
Well, let's be clear about this too, because these are people who are... either human or vaguely human.
Yeah, they're well, the weird thing is every creature in this book that's sentient, they call them humans. And the idea that sort of gets hinted at is that this is a future and I'll talk about my other theory later, that this is a future where we've genetically engineered ourselves so much that most of us barely even resemble human beings anymore. But so not only is the worker a human being, but different in some ways, reproduction, which I won't spoil that surprise at the end of the first arc. But the president that he is working for, which is described as just sort of amoebic blob that has to be held into human form with a meat shirt, is also a human. And then later in the story, you bump into people who are just heads on spider legs and creatures with face lids that that hide their whole face, and they're all humans. And so there's a sense of that never explicitly gotten into, but it just sort of develops this idea that this is at some point in the future where humans have just genetically engineered themselves so far. And in one of the stories, everybody is some kind of an insect creature. But they, in that story, they specifically call each other humans.
Yes. And that's what played into it for me. Number one was this idea that humans had evolved into this. Like, that depressed me. Do you know what I mean? Like, I was like, okay, so basically in 1,000 years or 1,500 years, like, my progeny are going to be living in sleep sacks, and they're going to, you know, be using nematodes and exoskeletons.
And using marrow pens, which I can only assume is some creature's bone that has been engineered to have ink in it, and then they use it to write on skin sheets, derma sheets. So in one scene there is a classroom, and the entire wall, that instead of being a blackboard, it's a sheet of skin that he scrapes onto, and it's the skin's reaction to being scraped that writes. And then at the end of the class, some of the students have to stay behind and put ointment on the skin so that it's just so bizarre.
It is bizarre.
It is so strange. But in the process of talking about that in such a matter of, because that's a gross image of having this sheet of skin that you've purposefully irritated to write on, and then the kids have to spread ointment on this skin
so that it heals itself over.
But it's presented in such a matter-of-fact way that at the end of the scene, at the beginning of the scene, you're like, oh. But by the end of it, it's just, you've just kind of rolled, and you're like, okay, that's the world that they live in. And that's why I said it's like an undystopia, because it should be a dystopia.
Yes.
But yet it somehow is not. It's not.
Well, initially I likened it to...
At least not to me.
Because Douglas Adams has that kind of casual, casual silliness.
Yeah.
And at first I was like, is this where this guy's going with this, but in kind of a darker way? But then it kind of became, I don't know if you've ever read anything by Michael Moorcock.
I don't think I have, no.
But he's written a bunch of stuff. He's written, obviously he wrote the Bane of the Black Sword, the Elric series, Von Beck.
No.
But he also wrote a series called The Cornelius Quartet. And I read that book like every couple of years because it has such like an emotional impact on me. Because it's like, it has no rules.
Oh, that's
cool. And just to kind of give you a backstory on that story, it's about this guy who is a rock star, a physicist, and an assassin.
This is, three completely, like the Natalie Portman character that we were talking about from Annihilation. It has to be three things at once.
And he's in love with his sister, which is kind of the weird part. And he has this really incestuous relationship with her. And he and his other brother get into this, like, this needler fight, and they end up killing her. Or, like, in a, like, mortally wounding her. So he puts her into, like, suspended animation, and he creates this machine that is supposed to reverse time so he can go back and save her. And what ends up happening is... it ends... No, it doesn't. It ends up shattering time. And every time he engages it, you know, something about the timeline changes. It's still moving forward, but a different way. And so, like America has turned into, like, a giant... Like, this is a civil war. And all the characters are the same.
Right.
You know... All the people are the same, except they occupy either, like, slightly lateral positions in the story, or they're completely different. So, and...
That's pretty standard time.
It is, except that, like, everything was so, like, meaningless and desolate.
Oh, you're talking about the tone.
Yeah, the tone of it. And I was like, oh, God, I'm gonna go to sleep now.
Like, very 1984-ish?
But, like, in the 60s. Like, that book was banned in, like, 50 countries.
Really?
Yeah. Because
it was so bad?
I mean, well, because it portrayed the Catholic priest as, like, a candy-eating pedophile or something weird like that.
Can't have that.
He was, like, actually the Pope. But there was no church. It was weird. Anyway, so everything was kind of just...
So you said the tone of this was...
The tone of it was, like, there's, like, this meaninglessness and this, right. like, sort of hopelessness. And I was like, oh, my
yes.
God.
Yes, in the one arc where the people had just resigned themselves to the fact that every now and then... animals were going to fall out of the sky and just smash into the street, and they had to clean it up and scoop all of them into this pool at the bottom of their town.
Yep.
That was called a filth bed.
Yeah, right.
And they were just used to this. You know, it was just part of your regular duties. You would have to go stand watch to see if these things, they call it a descent from heaven, but these creatures. Large ones, small ones, you know, insectoid creatures and other types of things would just fall out of the sky, smash all over the place, goo and blood going everywhere.
Yeah.
And everyone in this town was just resigned to it. It was just something that happened all the time.
Yeah.
And it was, but the weird thing is, after that happened, you know, the first time it happened, I got a sense of like it was a very Hollywood-y type scene. Because you can imagine the CGI scene that the first time that these creatures start falling out of the sky. But then... it happened again, and it happened again, and other things were going on in the story.
Sorry,
and you were. Oh, that's fine. But by that time, you had become just like the characters in the story. You were just like, oh, this is a part of the world that this rain of death comes out of the sky every once in a while.
Yeah,
it just unbelievably, just masterfully accomplished pulling the reader into a world that would and should be horrifying.
Yes.
But then it becomes not. It just becomes a, you know...
I think the word I'm looking for is anesthetized. I felt anesthetized by it. But not
feeling numb. It just felt me... It's kind of like when you move to a completely different state and you're so not used to something about that state. Like, if you move to New Jersey and you're like, oh, wait, that's right, I've got to turn right to turn left. I've got to go around that jug handle or whatever it is that they have there. But then after a while, you just don't even think about it anymore. You just do it.
Right.
And that's what it felt. I didn't feel numbed. I felt like all my senses were still, but I had just become, I was like, okay, this is where we are.
I mean, the worker was like, his existence is so miserable and meaningless that he has to sleep in a sack that basically erases his memory.
Right, yeah.
So.
it's filled with amnesiotic fluid.
Right, which at first I thought that was a typo. But like, let's talk about.
The language?
Let's talk about our criteria.
Okay, the criteria, we have three. Right?
We have three criteria.
Yeah.
And our first criteria is going to be prose.
Prose.
Yeah.
Which language,
how well it's written.
Next. For this one, or do you want to...
Let's go standard.
Do you want to list them first and then go into it, or do you
want to... Let's list them first and go into it,
So prose, and then the second one is plot or structure.
Right.
So you can imagine how one of those could be really good and one of those could be really bad. So we want these to be as independent as we could. And then the third one was... what was the word we finally decided on?
We said, like, idea or concept.
Oh, yeah. So, concept. That also can be completely, you can have a fantastic concept, bad writing and bad plot, or you could have a fantastically written plot, the structure of it, but bad the other two. Anyway.
And five stars. We're going to go with five stars.
Yeah,
One to five stars. Yeah.
And I like that. I like doing the one to something because every once in a while you're going to bump into something that's so awful that you get to say that phrase that people say all the time. I wish I could give it zero.
Right.
So I want to reserve that. So one to five is good. So that one day we're going to watch a movie read a book that's so terrible that we get this and we can both look at the screen at the same time and go, we wish we could give it zero.
I get a bad rap over that about like trashing. Like movies and stuff, but there are times when I've given people 1.5 stars when they didn't deserve it.
This is the way I think about it. If there's some movie that's or book that's trash, you didn't trash it,
right?
The person who created it the one who did it.
I'm trying to help you guys out with a good review with a good review of bad work.
It's not your fault. I mean, what are you going to do? You going to give Valerian?
Well, I may have said this on the podcast before, but I was recently. Ribbed. I was recently accused of giving bad stars just for the sake of it was cool to give bad stars.
Yeah, you're like a hipster,
right?
Yeah,
you know, like I'm wearing a handlebar mustache and a bowler, and I'm like, one star. So
I hated this movie before you even knew it was out.
That's how cool I am. I'm so trendy that, anyway. Okay, so we have our three criteria.
Yeah, we do. We do. And so the first one, prose or language. And this one is a little strange because we're kind of reviewing two people.
Yes.
The translator
and the original.
But I'll be honest with you. This is the only downside of the prose is I found that sometimes the sentences, one following another, kind of threw me. Like, what did that have to do with the previous sentence?
Yeah.
But the cleverness of the writing, the cleverness of the neologisms, the fact that they just rolled and they just kept you rolling in the world, and it was like it really felt like that the new words were rolling you up in a carpet just constantly. There was no break in the action. You never felt like, oh, here's the part that's kind of like the real world. It was always you were constantly immersed through the language. And language, it was so, and the writing was so easy.
Yeah.
It never felt belabored. That I have to give it five stars.
Kudos to Cuddleston.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, not only did he go in there and he translated his thing in a way where the book was still good in English, but he captured more than good. It was excellent. But he captured this nuance, and he also captured this I don't want to say dialogue, but he captured this vernacular that was specific to the book.
Right.
And I was like, amnesiotic? Like, oh my God. Right. I mean, there's a couple other words like
and
that. Exoskeleton.
Right, exoskeleton.
And I was like, oh man, that's...
And, like I was talking about the marrow pen, a lot of things were... Rarely did any word... Like, I think one time... They would occasionally say bugs, but usually they said they had a specific gloam bug,
right?
And it was everything in this story was very unique to the story. There was no holdovers. Like nobody was wearing a hat,
right?
Nobody's wearing a shirt. There were people wearing meat shirts,
right?
And other, you know, no, nothing from our world was carried over. Every time something got introduced, they had to come up with a word for it and a description for it. And or I'm saying, you know,
describe its function.
Yeah, the author had to come up with it, and then the translator had to come up with it.
And there was nothing superfluous about it. Everything fit.
It all fit together, and it threaded. And it, like I said, I wish that there were a glossary to this, because there's just so much. I don't know how. First of all, the author remembered all of these terms because they keep cropping up. You know, and that's what one of the things that makes it feel like a real world is that he doesn't just say, you know, something string worm or something like that, and then you never hear it again.
Yeah.
50 pages later, they talk about it again. It's just like, no, it's part of the world. And to me, that it was just this is a work of genius on the prose level.
Yes.
And
there's a part of this that I want to tap into before we move on to, which is because we talked about this and we're like, is this one of the things I was worried about when I picked the book was, is this going to be science fiction? And even once I got 60, 70 pages in, I was like, this is really, well, maybe like 30. I was like, this is really, you know, like I love Douglas Adams, but his work is comedy, essentially.
Right.
And it's dark, and you know, Long Dark Teacher of the Soul is like dark comedy. Right. So I was thinking that it would be like, oh, look, it's a Babel Fish. And you know, it was going to be something like that,
right,
where it was really kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, fanciful, like, or not.
It was a parody of, or... like almost satire.
It was too satirical, but too funny. And then it got like, but there was, and I was concerned that it wouldn't ultimately end up being science fiction.
But it
did.
Yeah.
It straight up, it was, but in a way that, because specificity is what science fiction is about.
Right.
Science is about specificity.
Right.
But he did it in a way where he didn't sit down and say, well, this nematode's genetic structure was.
Right, there's no explanation.
There's no explanation, but you know what a nematode is,
right,
and you know what its edge is, and you know, and so you know how all these things potentially fit together, and how humans have evolved to interact with these things.
Right.
So you know,
or even be these things,
right?
And because I think what he's doing in a lot of these places, because you know, I hesitate to say there's no exposition, because occasionally it will say something like, "Well, we haven't done this since the last time that we had the dust plague," and you know, but when he's doing that, he's not doing what a lot of science fiction authors are, which is author talking to the audience about, here's how light speed travel works in my universe.
Right.
It's the characters, just sort of stray thoughts that they're having about the world. Oh, yeah, we haven't had that, you know, oh, that building there, that's where they always have to meet. And
well, let's draw a line here, because we talked last in the last couple of episodes right. about rigorous science fiction, hard yeah. science fiction, and then fantasy.
Right.
And one of the things that we both understand is that you can't sit there. You know, people get their get in a tizzy over things like, oh, that faster than light travel concept is not.
It's not
scientific.
Right.
Well, you know what? I'm not going to spend a third of my book explaining the Alcubierre-Fronin drive to you.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Yes. Exactly.
Okay.
You have to be able to just establish that things are
thematically and scientifically
plausible. Yeah. Because here's the thing: if you had to show exactly how something could be engineered, you're no longer writing science fiction. You're writing a paper
yes.
for a science journal.
Yes.
And that's not. That defeats the whole purpose. I mean, if you're going to design a thing, that's science and that's engineering. That's not science fiction, though. The science fiction, to be rigorous, it has to be plausible,
right?
And it has to it has to be taken seriously. But I would say this too, because this is something I don't like about a lot of fantasy: is it has to be consistent with itself through the story. You can't have some kind of science do one thing. In one part of a story and then later do something completely different. Which is why, one of the things that was most troubling to me about The Force Awakens is when all those planets got destroyed in the same system. And I'm like, yeah, that's not how...
Right.
That's not how... Not only is that not how space works, but that's not how the other Star Wars movies presented that universe.
Yeah.
You know, in Episode 4, everything was very... I mean, there are a lot of things in there that were pure space opera... But the concept of where planets were in relation to each other was pretty realistic, and surprisingly so for that period of time. But then Force Awakens just threw that out and just had this goofy, completely unscientific concept of space geography.
Yes.
So that to me would be the thing. You have to be internally consistent with the science as well as it being plausible.
Yes.
And that's not often done. A lot of people just think that that's where they get to go. Well, it's just a story. It's like, no.
You have to thread the needle. There's no doubt between theme and substance.
Right.
But there's an element where you're going to bore part of your job is to take the things that are scientifically plausible and can be explained scientifically and explain them thematically
right.
in a way that's going to be engaging.
Right.
So that's what people
and
sort
a lot of times you don't.
Get either.
You don't do either. But if the thing is, and I think this book is a good example of it, is that you don't have to stop, and I've actually seen this in some science fiction books, is where text stops, double space, and then there's just flat exposition in, like, italics.
Right.
And it's like, and you can tell that all the author did was, somewhere they've got a file where they were writing how the world works, and they're like, oh, how am I going to work this in the story?
Yeah.
I'm not going to build it into dialogue. They do the lazy thing.
Yeah.
Rather than working it into dialogue or working it into the story somehow, they just cut and paste from their, their world building document and just throw it in there.
So I'm going to give the prose 3 stars.
Okay.
Just kidding.
I would be like, well, you're wrong, but...
I like you, I enjoyed the prose. And in some ways, for most of the same reasons.
Right.
But also my own additional reason, because, I spent a lot of time in Japan and... I participate. I mean, there was a movie that I watched back in the 80s called Tetsuo the Iron Man, which was supposed to be like the science fiction, ended up being this really awful bad art film.
Okay.
But there was so much in the film that you know, when it comes to art, if you go to Japan, the Japanese they're very friendly, they're very nice, but they're also very reserved.
Right.
They don't wear their hearts on the sleeve most of the time.
Right.
But in their art, they totally do. Like, you can see the
well,
things
it has to go somewhere.
The thing, yeah, why? So you can see the things that frighten them in their art, and you can see the things in this that. Like, that this guy either feared or that were in him, that he
right.
was like, I got to put this on paper.
He's working it up. But that may be one of the reasons why this is so artistic, is that, if you're just writing a story that's expressing your bullshit surface self,
right.
that's going to come out and you're just going to write some hack crap.
Right.
But, if this is what, this guy really digging down into his deepest fears and discomfort, that might explain why this is just such a beautiful, beautiful book, beautifully written.
Beautifully written book. So I'm giving the prose 5 stars. I'm giving the double 5-star to Huddleston and Torishima.
Yeah, I would say they both do, because I can't even imagine. This book made me want to learn how to speak or to read Japanese, because I want to know what the world is
translating. I'm pretty sure I'm going to go back and read this in Japanese.
Well, yeah.
I mean, admittedly, I don't have the skill.
Right.
at this moment to read that in Japanese, because that's like an academic level understanding.
It's just unbelievable.
But I definitely
not an easy, I don't want to say it's not an easy read, but it's because I don't think there's anything in there that would be hard for anyone who's, you know, high school level reading ability to get through. But what's difficult about it is Sisyphean, in the sense that you're constantly, there's no part of this book where you're just reading. It forces you to constantly build the world as you're reading it. Every single paragraph,
which will bring us to the plot
structure, is a block in the world.
But side note, there is no part of this book that's analogous to some dude pushing a stone up a hill. It's
not in the sense of
it's
tedium.
The task of reading and comprehending what's going on.
Absolutely, so, it would be it's only Sisyphean if you could rewrite the Sisyphus myth to a guy who was in heaven and he loved pushing stones up hills, and that's what he got to do for the rest of eternity. Because it's fun. There's nothing tedious about it. But it is one of those things. You can't, like a lot of books you get when you're 5 pages of dialogue and you're just flipping. No, every single paragraph requires you to chewing and you're savoring it like good food. Anyway, and that sounds weird because we're talking about a story that is constantly about blood and organs and mucus and slime cake. They're building things out of slime cake and the what was the name of the stuff that was that the Coaguland was made out of? The jelly slime.
The jelly slime.
And he got slogged into Coaguland, one of my favorite
words. Coaguland. Amnesiotic.
It's exactly what it sounds like.
If
you take the word coagulate and you take the word land and you're like, oh, this is land that is being coagulated out of something else, and you're like, yep, that's exactly how gross it is.
So, second criteria.
Plot structure. Okay. The way this was set up is that there are four, like, mini story arcs in a sequence. And although I'm not completely clear, my thought is that they're moving backward in time. That the first one is the latest, and then it moves back a little bit, and then it moves back a little bit.
I can see that,
I'm not sure, because something else happens in the fourth that maybe we won't get into, because I don't want to make this too complicated for people. And also, I don't want to spoil the fourth book. But the structure, the way that the four different stories, they do this amazing thing. And it is that they're clearly part of a coherent universe, but each one of these stories has a tone and a personality of its own.
Yeah.
The first one is very much a slice of life. Like we said, it's a worker who's going to work at a crappy job. He's got a crappy boss. There just happens to be an amoeba.
A tongue-shaped.
Yeah, a tongue-shaped amoeba man.
You're right.
But it's very much one of those slice-of-life sort of stories. The second one is almost a coming-of-age story about a boy who is supposed to become a taxonomist like his grandfather, but his grandfather is killed during these rain of creatures coming out of the sky. And so he starts to work for this shrine chieftain, and he gets into politics and learns about this conspiracy to keep a secret from people. Very much a different story.
Yes.
It's more of a cultural drama / coming of age story. Then you get to the third one, which is a straight up hard boiled mystery.
Yep.
Where everybody is an insect, and they're all living on these giant living castles that slide and roam around what's called a mud sea. And at the beginning of the book, the two of these castles, which are also towns, because people live on them, got married, which in a weird way kept them from exploding.
Right.
Because they gathered potassium nitrate until they... if they don't mate, if they don't get married to another castle, then they spread their seeds by just exploding their seeds all over.
Suiciding.
They call it suiciding. Fantastic wordplay in this book.
Yes.
Just brilliant. And
absolutely brilliant.
And then the last one is sort of this montage of a near future couple who are caught up in this sort of possible virtual reality glitch.
Yeah.
And a caravan of people who are moving across this sandy desert area, which has an almost Middle Eastern, Old Western feel to it.
Yeah.
Because they're herding these big, fluffy bugs called Mamanji.
For me, when I read that, I was thinking it was like Tatooine.
Yeah, it was.
It felt like a
Tatooine. But it felt, for some reason, flatter. Like, I just got this sense that this thing was just flat.
Yeah.
And that was kind of part of it. And there's a sense that the world that's in the fourth book, the flat, desert world is the same planet, at least, as the one in the second, because they're described very similarly. And that makes you think that maybe all these worlds are the same world, or maybe they're not even a world. Maybe they're a world constructed inside of a virtual thing, that there are these hints throughout all the stories that there's something else going on where people's consciousnesses are somewhere else.
Right.
And that's really what's going on. Which, the weird thing is when we talk about the sci-fi, is it sci-fi? And if it's, you know, genetic future sci-fi, you know, genetic engineering future sci-fi, if that qualifies.
Right.
But if it turns out, and I might have to read this again to see what I decide, if it turns out that it's a virtual reality that's gone wrong, that's, you know, like you said, it just, the skins are messed up, and
right,
and everybody, they just forgot that they're really humans,
right,
and
their avatars,
that also
their skins,
qualifies as sci-fi.
Right. But the interesting thing about it too is what it could be a virtual thing, but it could also be that there is this evolutionary process going on inside the virtual world.
Well, right.
But there's also, because to me, I was thinking, like when you said it could be virtual, I was like, oh, you know what? The sleep sack thing makes sense then, because that's the portal into the world.
Right.
Is, you know, you. Yeah. And also, you know, what happens.
Which we find out later is a womb.
Right.
So it's where you start.
Right. But you also go back into it.
You go back into it, and then you come back out.
And you're healed.
And you're healed, and all of your bad stuff is gone. Like, if they have these things, these lice-like creatures on the worker has on his head that we find out later in the story act up specifically when he's asking certain questions about the world.
Rod Kresge just joined.
Hey.
What's up, Rod Kresge? So I get that that it could be moving backwards. Structurally, admittedly, in the beginning, I was like, this arc is going to be really long. Because he's hyper focusing on like even these details.
Yep.
This is how it's going to be. Right. Yeah. This is going to be forever. But beautifully, as you came out of that second story, you could see it starting to kind of manifest itself.
It's kind of like when they have those. Have you ever seen those videos of the homes that unfold themselves?
Right.
And when you first see it, you're like, this. There's no way this is going to fold out into a full size house.
Right.
And then boom,
it does.
And that's exactly what this does. And by the time you get into the third arc, you're just like, it's like an entire Foundation series compressed into a single novel.
Yes.
That's how vast it feels.
Well, that's why I call it like a realized naked lunch, because it wasn't like, oh, I'm just a cockroach in a typewriter typing. It's like, oh no, I have all these other really exotic things.
Right.
By the way, they're actually humans.
Right, and and that's the thing. When you all the different species of bugs that are living on the castle,
and he didn't anthropomorphize. Like
no.
You're like, here's my boss.
Right.
I got a tongue shaped head.
Very specific about like when they were doing the bugs. Very specific that they communicated through scent, not visual.
Those of you who just joined, by the way, we're reviewing this book, Sisyphean, and it is a science fiction book by Denpao Torishima. It's a real mind trip. Once this goes up online, saved, you'll be able to go back and see what we had to say about it. We had a lot to say about it.
Yeah.
So would you give it for plot structure?
I have to give it 5.
Gotta give it 5.
It's literary level.
It was solid.
Yeah, it's literary.
Not just solid. It was. Yeah, you're right. Literary.
And the thing is, it was innovative. And a lot of times when people try to do things innovatively, like, you know, the very first time they try to do a triple flip, they kind of land a little bit off. No.
You didn't lose anything else in the story. So yes, 5 stars. So we are coming up on time, so we gotta get to this last part.
The last part is the concept. Well, I mean, I think we've established what we're about the concept.
Yeah. It's unusual. The concept is unusual. If you're like looking for shoot 'em up, you know, space, whatever, you're this is not it.
No.
But if you're looking for something that's thoughtful, that's gonna make you drill down and look at things like really up close. This is definitely,
and it's something that you're going to enjoy every single page. Well, if you like the story, you're going to like every single page of this book.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, I did too. It's just amazing. And I mean, some of it I liked a little bit. Like I liked the third arc a lot because it was a hard boiled mystery, and I kind of liked those already. And he pulls it off. He pulls off the sense of humor that you have in those old detective novels.
It's so
really
wry,
well.
Though. It's like,
it is, yeah.
I mean, you know, it's
he
like
almost, he keeps almost getting raped by female bugs that are trying to plant eggs into his carapace. And,
yes,
and it just kind of.
I'm pretty sure
but
he
rolls
got that from,
with it the same way a hard-boiled
so
detective.
He got that from Isabella Rossellini.
Yeah, but he just rolls with it the same way that you know that that Sam Spade or somebody would. You know, it happens, and he's like, "Ah, well, now I got to go do this job." It's just fantastic.
Rod Kresge says that he wants thoughtful. Well, this is definitely for
absolutely,
you, Rod.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's going to trip you out.
Yeah,
it might even, you know,
yeah.
Like I felt at various times like I was just stoned. Like I was like,
yeah, it leaves you feeling like you're. It's one of those weird few books that actually just changes your whole feeling about things in general. Yeah.
Yeah, he's an antipsychotic. Because I mentioned when I posted about it that we had psychotic breaks while reading it.
Yes, yeah.
So,
just you go through it and you just see, like.
I played the piano in my underwear, so.
I didn't do that. But I did have, I mean, like, I finished reading this for a little while, went to go to the sink to go wash my dishes. And, you know, everybody has that gross moment when you accidentally touch food in the thing.
Yeah. Right?
Didn't bother me.
Right.
And I thought, and that bothered me. The fact that
The sedges will get to
and
it.
Why is this would gross me out? And I suddenly realized there's so much stuff in here that he just gets you used to, just grossness.
Right. I viewed it like, well, that was still gross, but I'll forget about it once I get into the sleep sack.
But you won't.
I won't.
You won't.
So
yeah, fantastic book. Five stars.
Five stars. Yeah,
across the board.
And the funny thing is that like, so this is our first time doing the codified, you know, like
right.
Rating, and the first one. I'm gonna pat myself on the back a little bit for choosing this one.
Yeah, no, absolutely, because it's fantastic. I mean, which one did I choose? I chose. I can't remember what was the book that I chose. Oh yeah, it was the Punishment.
Punishment. Which is a good book.
Yeah, it was a good book.
But
yeah.
but it wasn't Demon
Hoshima. It
wasn't this.
No, I mean no.
And I'm definitely
this
the next
time
I go to Osaka, I'm gonna look this guy up and see if he'll like do an interview or something.
That would be yeah.
So,
how often do you get out there where your family's?
Right? Well, not recently, but you know there's some trips on the books coming up, so maybe sometime later this year. But yeah, so 5 stars, we loved it.
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of my favorite books. I mean, it's like. Anytime that I
learned something, like
anybody that I think is a serious reader who really wants to read something that's I want to say challenging, it's not challenging, but really, really loves and appreciates good writing and good literature and good structure and good concepts, who's not just wanting a beach read, then this is the book that I would go, I got something for you to read
right. That's
going to change the way you look at everything.
Yeah.
Very rarely is there a book like that.
Let me see, we've got, okay, so what's going to happen now is we're going to sign off, but we're going to be back in like 10 minutes.
Right.
We're going to be back in 10 minutes to,
do our episode 6.
Do episode 6.
Which would be?
Which is going to be Science and Science Roundup.
Or,
yeah.
Depending on where you're from.
Horns up. But thank you for tuning in. I hope that you enjoyed, our book review. And, we'll see you in about 10 minutes. Otherwise, we'll see you in like a month.
Yeah. Your choice. It's all completely up to you.
Talk to you later.
See you. Thanks for showing up.